This is Unheard Cuts on Being. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with literary historian Paul Collins and artist and author Jennifer Elder. They are also parents of Morgan, who has autism. I spoke with them on August 22, 2007, from the studios of APM in St. Paul, Minnesota. They were in the studios of Oregon Public Broadcasting in Portland, Oregon. This interview is included in our show, Autism and Humanity. Download the MP3 of the produced show at onbeing.org.
They're already on the line, so you should be able to talk to them.
Okay.
Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, this is Jennifer.
Hi, it's Krista.
Hi.
Oh, hi.
Oh, hi, this is Paul.
Yeah, nice to have you on the other end of the line. Microphone. I'm really, really delighted that you agreed to do this. I mean, do you have any questions of me about the show? Or what? Sorry. Okay. If you do, Mitch thinks, my producer here thinks they're still setting up at your end, so...
Oh, yeah.
Yes, they said they're still... having technical difficulties.
Yeah.
Okay. But Mitch, we can talk, can't we? Okay. I don't want to talk about anything substantive, though. But
okay.
If you want, let's just talk.
I can handle that.
Trivial. But if you did have, you know, if you have any questions, fire away.
I don't think so, but I really enjoyed your interview with Barbara Kingsolver.
Oh, yeah. I went out and planted a garden after that for the first time.
Oh, really?
Yes. It really affected me practically.
Yeah, it really was good. I actually think I might go listen to the long one.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I guess that's hardcore when you're listening to the long version of the radio, but it's really great that you guys have that.
Well, you know, we just started putting those up about... I don't know, a month ago, 6 weeks ago, and my online editor really wanted us to do it. And it's been amazing how many people listen to those and really appreciate it. And that's kind of, sorry.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, I've noticed that a lot of like print publications now will have, you know, they have the usual interview that you see in print, but then you can basically see the interview in its entirety online. It's a great idea.
We've actually just also started sometimes taping the sessions we have where, which we call cuts and copy, where I've written the script and we're going through the kind of roughly edited interview and we're having a big group session about how we need to shape this and set it up and what people know and what they don't know and how the editing is. And it's very rough, but my online editor again thinks there's a big audience for this kind of raw content. It's the new world we inhabit. So I see Mitch is deep in discussion about something.
Oh, by the way, honey,
yes.
It has the volume in your headphones because there's a little control over here.
Oh, there is? Mine sounds good.
Oh, okay.
This is my first time doing this, so Paul's sort of showing me the ropes.
Yeah, I know Paul's an expert. And
that's very much in quotation marks, I think.
Well, you're a pro. You've done this before, and I know you're a good talker. And I guess, you know, I really wish, since there are three of us, that I was in the room with you, but you'll have verbal cues from each other. And I guess, you know, because this is not live and we don't have to cut it down to 10 minutes, we really do get to have a free-flowing conversation. And you may jump on each other's words sometimes, and that's okay. I want to talk about both of your books, and I want to start with some of the, okay, Mitch.
I just want to tell Stephen, the level coming to me is very low. I'm just wondering if that can be boosted at all.
Yeah, it sounds low to me too.
Should I be getting closer to the mic maybe? Is that going to help at all?
I think it needs a lot more than that, I'm afraid.
Okay.
I thought maybe that was just my volume being turned down. No.
What's that, Freddie? You should say something.
Don't keep moving it.
Don't move it. Okay.
I'm going to try calling one.
Okay.
Adjust it.
Okay.
Because every time it moves, they have to kind of rejigger it.
So, yeah, Krista, you weren't planning on necessarily directing the questions, or were you going to direct the questions to one of us or the other?
Well, what I was going to say is at any given moment, it may be it may be more directed to one of you, or one of you may have more to say, but I, you know, I want to encourage the other one to pipe up if you feel like it.
Right.
Let's just try to have a natural three-way conversation, and it will work.
Okay.
Yeah. And I've done a lot of reading and preparing, and yet I, you know, my measure of a good conversation is when we leave my notes and we're just really talking
right.
and getting yeah. somewhere. And
so are you in Minnesota?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is it raining on you? How's it?
It's been raining for days. It's yeah. so strange. We had the most perfect summer up to now, although it was too dry, and now it's just been too wet. But it's not,
right.
we're up here, there's flooding happening about an hour or two south. And it's not
wow.
actually flooding here, but it's very strange.
So, I'm wondering if Stephen can hear me.
I don't hear Stephen anywhere. Did you try to call him? You know, maybe he said he had something else to finish up. Do you think maybe that's what he's doing? No.
Paul, can you see Stephen through the glass at all?
No, there's actually no panel here for that. But I'll poke my head out and take a look.
Okay. So you live in Portland now, right, Jennifer?
Yes.
And
mm-hmm.
but you're not from there, are you?
No. This is the engineer.
Oh, hi. Okay.
Hi, Steve. This is Mitch Hanley. Say, I'm wondering, the level just seems really low coming to me. That first of all, and secondly, is there a phone number where you can be reached during the interview?
Yeah, absolutely. It's 503-293-1997.
Is that your desk?
Yeah.
So you won't be actually sitting in the interview?
Well, you know, I would love to, but one of our consoles actually went down this morning, so I had to put everybody into a production room. There's a couple of Neumann mics in here, so it should sound okay, but unfortunately, I have basically no control over it.
Okay. Is it possible to boost the level that I'm getting?
Is the level that is coming from my mic fine right now?
Yours is better than theirs.
Yeah. Okay, so let me see what I can do here. Yeah, if you can give me just a second, okay?
Sure.
Let me see what I can do.
Hi.
Hey. We're having fun.
Okay. Do you want me to move? Oh. If I can.
It's a good thing I can't see. Otherwise, it'd be dangerous. There should be one and two.
Oh, okay. Just give me a check.
Yes, Jennifer's mic. How does it sound?
I don't think it's really getting much louder.
No.
Let's see here. And could you give me a quick check on this microphone?
Sure. This is Paul's microphone. And how are the looking on that?
That's a lot better. I'm wondering if Jennifer's microphone can come up a little bit more than...
Yeah, they're saying mine's coming through a lot better, but that Jennifer's is not quite.
Yeah, you know, I wonder if maybe it was probably would just work better if you guys just shared this microphone, yeah.
Okay.
At this point, because I can't...
Can we both speak into it at the same
I'm not actually sure what kind of mic... If we're both talking off axis,
is that
going
to work for us, Mitch?
Actually, no. Let's just... Let me just hear Jennifer talking into her own mic for a second.
My own mic. Okay.
Yeah. And when you lean in, I don't know, Jennifer.
Whatever's better.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is me on my own mic.
Can I hear Paul?
Yeah, and this is me on my mic.
Okay, I think we'll just have to make that work.
Okay. I wonder if Paul is leaning in a little bit more.
No? I am leaning a little bit right now.
I would say Jennifer.
Jennifer
has a bit softer voice. Maybe just lean in. The microphone is your friend.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a lot better.
Okay.
Okay.
That'll
great.
Do. Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
That's it. Yep. Okay, great. Let me just ask you this. Now, Paul, your book was, Not Even Wrong, was that published in 2004? Is that right?
Right.
And
yeah,
so,
it came out in the spring of 2004.
How old was Morgan when you were actually writing it? He was young,
right? Yeah, I started writing it not real long after his diagnosis, maybe within 5 or 6 months of it. So he was about 3 and a half at the time.
Okay.
And I finished it about a year later when he was 4 and a half.
Yeah. And how old is he now?
Wait.
8 and a half.
He's
wait,
8 and a half.
Yeah.
Wait, my own chronology is getting getting mixed up here.
Well, I know there's always this lag time between the writing and the publishing.
Right.
And so so he's 8 and a half now.
Yes.
Okay. All right.
So I guess I finished it when he was...
It came out when he was 5.
All right.
Okay.
And that would make sense.
Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, there's the cliffhanger. Yeah.
English majors doing that.
Yeah. Yes, there's the cliffhanger. We'll get
at the end
that.
Of the book. Yes. Okay.
And, you know, it was really interesting. It struck me when I was reading the beginning that you were new parents. You were first-time parents. And Morgan's normal was normal to you.
Right. We didn't know anything else.
We really had no basis of comparison because, for one thing, we'd been moving around a lot. So we didn't have a situation where we could watch someone else's child developing over the course of several years and actually notice that the sort of the milestones were progressing really differently for other people's kids.
But, you know, we used to notice that what we just thought was his unique personality. Like when he was a baby, we used to joke that he was inscrutable because he would just look at you, you know, for a long time without sort of smiling or laughing. But we didn't know that was anything, you know, there was anything strange about it.
Well, and he sounds like toddlers are kind of strange, eccentric beings and inscrutable in a way. And I mean, I also, you know, you also knew that he was smart and you knew that he was happy. Right.
That was one thing that really threw me off actually was that he had what's known as cognitive scatter, which is that some of his abilities were quite advanced for his age, or at least progressing, you know, quite typically, and others had barely progressed at all. And, you know, you usually think of developmental delays in a child as being kind of an all-around thing.
Yeah.
And so when I saw that some abilities were really coming along, I just assumed, well, you know, he's a late talker.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's doing so well in all these other things, so things must be going fine. And not realizing, of course, that that's really one of the almost defining characteristics with autism, that some abilities can actually become quite advanced.
Right. You know, there's this question you ask in the book, you know, after you go to the doctor, not really going because you think anything's wrong with him, just for a checkup, and you say, how can it be that we left our house an hour ago with a healthy toddler and returned with a disabled one? Did you have that same...
Absolutely. And I think that to some extent, there was a little bit of denial at the beginning. And I remember asking the people who diagnosed him or who evaluated him, well, if you give him this this disability label now, can he, can this be sort of expunged from his record later?
As if that when was, you're proven wrong.
Yeah. Right. Or just that, yeah, if he grew out of it.
Yeah.
And so I think that I just didn't want to... I didn't want to take anything just on face value. You know, I wanted to. It may have been denial, but I think it was also caution on our part. You know, at that point, it was just starting to there to be a lot of children diagnosed with autism.
Right,
and we didn't want to just rush headlong into it.
And it was
also
I'm
sorry. One of the really curious things too was that in the early days, it was actually surprisingly difficult to get a really straight answer from anybody about this. Nobody really wanted to commit and just say, in a single sentence, your son is autistic.
This is the late 90s we're talking, right?
Yeah. This is actually 2002.
Okay.
2001 and 2002.
Mm-hmm. And he was getting all these evaluations done, and they would break it down into the specific characteristics. Well, he's scoring low on this ability and low on this ability, and he has this set of characteristics, et cetera, et cetera. But it was actually not until even really a couple of years later that we finally got a formal medical diagnosis. But, for example, the local educational experts didn't want to just say your son's autistic because that's not part of their brief. They don't give diagnoses okay. like that. And so it was very strange initially. You would come out of a meeting and go, so what exactly did they just tell us about our child?
Right. And I guess what I'm learning, and I think you describe on so many levels, is it's not one thing, autism, right? It's a spectrum of human character and behavior, right? So you still have to get to know your child and what it means that your child has this diagnosis.
And I think that cuts right to the heart of both of our works, that we that there's a spectrum and that we see the world in a completely different way now. That we, it's not just Morgan. We now see these traits running through our family and through society.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was something that really was kind of a turning point for me too, which was that, you know, I think initially when we had the doctor saying, well, you need to have him looked at for developmental delays, it seemed like something had happened to our child.
Right.
You know, we had brought him in and he was fine, and then we brought him out of the office and he was not.
Right.
It was just very mystifying. And over time, what I came to see was that, yeah, not only is there a broad spectrum of autistic behavior, but, yeah, because these traits actually run through families and not in the form of full-blown autism necessarily, mm-hmm. but you can see some of the traits very commonly, particularly in male relatives.
Hmm.
When I first heard about that and started looking around at my own family, it really transformed my understanding of my family. And in some ways, people like my brother and my father started to make a lot more sense. And I think that was the same for Jennifer with her family as well.
Well, let's talk about that. That's one of the things you write about in the book, that you discovered that, in fact, there is data, there are studies about not just traits of autism, but professions, right? Engineers and artists and scientists tend to be in families
where
autism turns up.
Yeah, there's been really fascinating research on this done by Simon Baron Cohen at Cambridge University. And he's what he noticed essentially was that there seemed to be a lot of autistic siblings in particular of students of his who were in science-related majors, and you know, math students as well, and engineering students, and that kind of thing. And so initially, he simply looked at just sort of did an informal study comparing English majors and the rates of autism in their families with a number of science majors. And so the science majors that he was looking at had rates that were like 5 and 6 times that of autism in their families. Interestingly enough, the English majors had much, much higher rates of manic depression in their families, which is suddenly all makes sense.
Well, right.
And then when he expanded to studying the broader population, he found that this held up, that actually when you looked at the professions that family members of people with autism were in, they tended to be in things like accounting, engineering, computer programming, and had very low rates of employment in fields like sales, for example,
okay,
which
is
all about social contact.
Right. One way you described this thing was solitary professions requiring deep focus and abstraction, which also includes artists in that category.
Yeah, and there's actually musicians were very uh-huh. highly represented in particular, but also visual artists. among these families that he was looking at. And the interesting thing about that for me is the first reaction a lot of people have when they hear his research is they'll say, well, sure, my dad's an engineer. I mean, in my case, my dad is an engineer.
Okay.
my brother is finishing a PhD in computer science. And so the reaction you have is, well, it is a little bit of shock initially because he's right. He pegged their professions pretty well.
Right.
But at the same time, you think, well, but they're not actually autistic.
Yeah.
And that's sort of his point, really, is that these traits in a much less highly expressed form, or less overexpressed form, I guess you could say, naturally make people much better fitted for these professions.
And I think this is such an important point, and I'm kind of surprised. I was surprised as I was reading your work that I hadn't heard more about it. Because another thing that it does is, and I think that you say it this way at another point as well, that it reveals that autism is as much about a spectrum of abilities as disabilities in many cases. I wondered if so much of the public debate about autism has tended to focus on what causes it, right? Something going wrong,
right.
Something happening to the child from an outside force. And this kind of brings... Those are maybe completely separate discussions that both need to happen, but this one brings it back to, who we are as human beings, and it actually connects an autistic child or personality to the other human beings that they're related to.
This is part of a raging debate in the autism community, which is there's sort of a couple of factions, and the cure faction,
right,
that's really looking to eliminate autism. And then there are people on the other side, which is more the category we would fall into, who say, wait a minute, before we eliminate this, what are we going to lose?
Yeah.
Because, you know, does this mean that there would have been no Isaac Newton?
You know,
and so, you know, from our point of view, we're not ready to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
And I think that's and one of the difficult things about that, too, is that it's, you know, very clear to anyone, you know, who spends any time with an autistic child or an autistic adult that, particularly in cases of profound autism, it's an extraordinarily challenging condition. And, mm-hmm. and you probably wouldn't find too many people arguing that. That this shouldn't be ameliorated as much as possible, and that in particularly extreme cases of it, that's not something that, you know, that we would want to be searching for some sort of cure or prevention. Mm-hmm. But yeah, because autism encompasses such a broad spectrum and so many abilities within that spectrum, it becomes a real question that do you want to be losing all of that too? And I think our society literally wouldn't look the way it does today. There are probably quite a few computer companies, for one thing, that wouldn't be in existence.
Yeah, I was just gonna...
if it wasn't for the autistic community and the whole spectrum that sort of their families really often encompass.
Right. I mean, you also, in among your adventures, Paul, you went to Microsoft. And it wasn't clear to me if you did that in the context of your book research, or were you doing some other work there?
Strangely enough, it was actually for my first book that had come out the year before at that point, called Banvard's Folly, and which was a book about sort of failed or forgotten inventors and artists, and so they brought me up to just do a discussion with their employees. And in the middle of all this, as they were inviting me up, all this started happening with Morgan, with his diagnosis. And so I asked them, well, you know, while I'm up there, do you happen to have anyone working on autism-related issues? Because I'd heard a lot of whisperings among people that there was a fairly major autism community in a lot of computing companies. And they said, well, yes. We certainly do have a lot going on here in that regard. And so, that actually grew out of a visit that was already going to happen. And for me, the strangest moment there was when I was giving, I was speaking, I think, primarily with the what they described as the math wing of Microsoft. So you had a lot of people doing sort of theoretical mathematical work and working with algorithms and things like that. And I was addressing this room, and all these people were working on their laptops as I was talking, even before I started talking.
And so they were looking at the laptops rather than at you while you were speaking?
Yeah, for the entire speech. Mm-hmm. And at first I thought, wow, these are really busy people. But then I realized from some of the questions that they were then asking that they were, in fact, listening to me. And afterwards, I mentioned it to someone, like, what an odd thing that they were working on their laptops the whole time. And they said, well, they were watching the webcast of you.
Even though you were in the room.
I was like 15 feet away from some of these people. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, that's just how they prefer to interact. But, you know, I think in a way that's, I mean, at one level, when you see something like that, you go, well, that's kind of strange.
Yeah.
but at the same time, I think it's also really great that we live in an age where people who may, you know, I think in the past probably wouldn't have gone to a lecture like that at all just because of all the social contact that it would have entailed.
But now they have the computers.
Yeah, they have a way to interact that in the past it would have been just much too uncomfortable or, you know, kind of painful for them to deal with.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, again, the point you've been making is that it is that very same personality type set of skills that enables them to do this work somehow.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the way that Simon Baron Cohen described it to me was he said, all these professions I look at have a systematizing tendency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're seeking an internal logic within a system. And and that lends itself beautifully to fields like mathematics or computing, which in a lot of ways is basically a subset of math.
Right.
You know, at the same time, it makes it extraordinarily difficult for them to deal with the highly illogical world of people.
Yes. Yeah. I found it fascinating that one of your responses, Paul, to Morgan's diagnosis was to kind of go back in history and look for autism in history and in the human imagination, and you also found that you'd kind of been staring it in the face in a historical character who had already come to fascinate you, and that was Peter the Wild Boy. And tell me about that.
Yeah, that was kind of unnerving for me in a way.
Yeah,
I'd been working on sort of taking notes for a potential book on this fellow Peter the Wild Boy, who was a feral child found in the Black Forest in 1725. And King George took an interest in him and brought him back to the court in London. And he wound up really becoming this figure right at the center of the intellectual life of the time. He was taken into the court physician's home, which, Dr. Arbuthnot, who was someone who was friends with Jonathan Swift and with Defoe.
Hmm.
He knew people like Halley and Newton. And so, I mean, this guy went from living in the forest to suddenly being at the intellectual center of Europe. And yet he didn't really talk.
Right.
And so he was this figure that everybody expounded all these theories about, and he was kind of at the silent center of it. You know, almost this Harpo Marx kind of
right.
thing in the middle of all this intellectual ferment going on around him. And I it really fascinated me. And nobody had actually written a book about him. So I was starting to research a book on him. And it was in the middle of that I started realizing that this looked pretty clearly like an early case of autism. And because there were so many people writing descriptions of him, he was really the talk of the town for quite a while in London.
Right. You wrote, he haunted the births of romanticism, zoology, and even the theory of evolution. I mean, he was
yeah, that's right. Rousseau had him in mind when he was talking about sort of the concept of the noble savage. People thought that Peter was a perfect example of the state of nature.
Hmm.
And that here was what people were like before civilization had somehow taken over.
Right.
At the same time, zoologists were also interested in him. He was seen as some sort of some sort of missing link. There was this one figure, Lord Mombado, in Britain, who developed kind of a proto-evolutionary theory in the 1780s. And he really saw Peter as this this link between orangutans and humans. So he really became this extra... And
but that was quite a revolutionary idea then, that there was even a link between orangutans and humans.
Yeah, it wasn't well received. And Samuel Johnson made a lot of fun of him, actually, for coming up with this theory. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it would be a long time before the world was ready for Darwin, I think.
Right.
But yeah, Peter was at the center of all this stuff. And the funny thing being that he had absolutely nothing to say about it and kind of couldn't care less. He was just sort of in his own world and living on a farm and sort of living this very... rural existence and having really no concept of all the fuss he had created and not even particularly caring for much of his life. It just but people took this tremendous interest in him. And yeah, for me, you know, he was this fascinating kind of mirror to hold up to the age, to look at all of the people's reactions to him. But it was that actually started before Morgan got diagnosed and after he got diagnosed. I had this just weird moment where I realized I've been studying an autistic figure from history for months and I've got, you know, someone with autism right in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't know if that was sort of a subconscious thing or I don't know.
Yeah. You said Peter was just in his own world, and it seems that that is really... That's kind of a short definition of autistic personality, isn't it? And even a kind of an origin of the term itself, which is self, the Greek for self, autos.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, there are two doctors who came up with that that term independently.
Yeah,
at
that's
almost the same
interesting
time.
Story too.
Doctor,
yeah,
yeah, Dr. Kanner and Dr. Asperger. And actually, you know, Asperger's syndrome is well known today, but that term has only been used for a couple of decades. But yes, they both came up with the term autism from the Greek auto, the self. And I think it's maybe the only term that one could use. I can't imagine, you know, what else one might call this this state of being. It certainly is, you know, when we watch Morgan, I think a lot of people watching him for a short period of time might imagine that he has no need for anyone else. But of course, you know, we live with him, so we get to experience his interacting or his initiating contact with us. But to anybody else, it would be quite subtle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's one of the funny things is that, yeah, Morgan, I think like any autistic person really, interacts a lot with the outside world. In fact, you know, most of his speech consists of either of demands from the outside world, you know, asking for things in a very instrumental way,
yeah,
or of repeating things that he hears, which is a really common tendency. It's known as echolalia, that, you know, lines from books or things from songs or things on TV. In a way, his mind is kind of filled with all these cultural artifacts that he kind of replays over and over again. So he's actually, in his own way, he's really fascinated with the outside world. And he interacts with us. There are times that he really wants us to be sitting with him or to explain something. But it's entirely on his own terms. You know, when he doesn't feel like interacting, he simply won't respond.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what really... You know, you don't expect that from people normally. You expect people to at least take a polite interest when you approach them
right.
about whatever. And for him, it's really, you know, either he wants to interact or he doesn't. And there's kind of no in between.
You know, I've often explained it to people who weren't familiar with an autistic child that it's like somebody watching a video and you're trying to get their attention, but... At the worst, they don't hear you at all, or at best, you're sort of bugging them and they try to swat you away.
Right.
And that's what Morgan's like all the time. He's got something, you know, he's got sort of a video running in his head, and you really have to get up in there to get his attention.
Right.
The funny thing, too.
Sorry. Yeah, keep going.
The funny thing, too, is that is that I'm kind of like that.
Yes.
Well, again, there's that spectrum, isn't there?
Yes. And I mean, that was one of the really strange moments for me, and particularly when I saw Baron Cohen's work. It was recognizing these traits within myself. And
like what? That, give me an example.
Well, for me, it's really two things in particular. One is, I guess, what you could call auditory processing. I actually was tested for hearing damage a lot as a kid because my teachers thought that I was partly deaf. And they couldn't figure it out because every time they'd test me, not only was my hearing quite good, it was actually extremely good. Mm-hmm. It was unusually sharp hearing. And it's funny because nobody ever asked me, I don't think, as a child. I don't know if I could have explained it at the time. But basically, when I'm focused on something, I can hear quite well. Mm-hmm. But when I'm I can hear that thing quite well. But when I'm focused on an object or a project or whatever, it has the effect for me of almost as if I'm turning my ears off. I just don't hear what's going on around me. And the ironic thing for me is that I can't imagine having a career as a historian without having that tendency.
Right.
You know, because I'm able to go into archives for hours at a time and just focus. And it's like diving underwater or something. I just don't even hear the outside world.
And we think this might be part of the connection between autism and what you might call genius, is the ability to focus on something.
Single-mindedness.
You know, absolutely, because in order to come to a conclusion, you may have to think about something without without your mind wandering for a terribly long period of time. And Paul can do that. But, of course, when I want to get his attention for a minor matter,
yes,
it can be difficult.
Right.
It's almost like having to shake me awake or something when I'm working on something. And so I think, what Morgan experiences is a much higher degree of that. But it's something that's, I think, helped me a lot in working with him, that I don't take it personally that he's somehow ignoring me or something.
Yeah.
I actually understand.
I know. I was struck. So it seems to me, so yes, he lives in his own world, to some degree we all do, but to very different degrees. But it seems as his parents, you do come to understand many of the contours of that world. I mean, right, you're watching the same video to some degree. I know in your book, Paul, when you talked early on about, and this was before the diagnosis, and I'm sure it happened after the diagnosis, but you talk about how he would lean into you, where maybe another child would look you in the eyes and hug you or say something to you. But you didn't experience that to be an inferior form of communication. You knew what that meant, right? That was his.
Yeah.
He really was leaning into you in every sense of the word.
That's one really interesting thing, and I've noticed this too with when Jennifer and I go into autism classrooms and that kind of thing, mm-hmm. where you see a lot of autistic children. There's a lot of people have the notion that people with autism are averse to contact and particularly averse to touch. That it's too much stimuli for them, and they don't know how to deal with it. And that's partly true, but that doesn't mean that they don't want contact with other people.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that they really want it on their own terms.
It's different, right.
Yeah, and so in Morgan's case, if you, went up to him and tried to look him in the eye, I mean, first of all, trying to look him in the eye is not going to work because he'll look away. But also, just trying to talk to him straight in his face or to give him a hug like that, he's quite likely to pull away. But what he loves is... He'll like climb onto our laps and want us to kind of hug our arms around his sides, and to hold him like that, because then he's getting that warmth and that contact from us, but it's not in a really overwhelming way of face-to-face interaction. And in fact, in a lot of autism classrooms, they have this is actually such a common phenomenon that in a lot of autism classrooms they have weighted blankets. That to calm the children down, sometimes they'll be shaped sort of like a poncho, that they'll put this weighted blanket around the child, and the pressure will actually calm them down. It's like being held, but it doesn't have that they don't have people in their face to a degree that they can't handle.
I think some of your listeners may be familiar with Temple Grandin,
yes.
who's a sort of maybe the best known autistic person in the world. And she constructed a machine for herself that would squeeze her to sort of give her that feeling, that that comfortable feeling. And there's a, also a version of that that they use to comfort livestock.
Right. I mean, I'd heard about her work with livestock, but not that she had also done that for herself.
Yeah, and it's and I work with children with special needs, and they have at the school where I work a sensory room that encompasses a lot of different sort of activities. But one of the things they have is just a big soft sort of a pit where the children can lie down and then have quilts heaped upon them. And this is surprisingly popular. Like, children line up for this just to be weighed down with blankets.
You know, you wrote you wrote a children's book, Autistic Planet, which I think just came out recently, didn't it? Is it?
Yes.
Yeah. And I suppose it really is. Well, you talk about what I'm curious about. Were you writing this book for autistic children or for other people, for the rest of us or for other children? Because you are kind of trying to help somebody see inside this different way of thinking and being in the world.
It's a bit of both because I think, you know, not all autistic children can read or understand this book. But for those who are higher functioning, it's you know, sort of a self-esteem booster, I think would be.
Yeah.
But I was also really writing it for the families and people who know autistic children. And there's sort of a lot of inside jokes in here that may not make much sense unless you know somebody with autism. But I wanted to both demystify it and have a little fun with it because there are a lot of things that I think autistic children might find embarrassing or frustrating if they have a you know, sense of the social implications. Like, for instance, stimming, well, some people might notice that autistic children tend to rock or move, move around. Or flap their hands, and that could be something that it can mark a child out if you don't know what it is they're doing. But I wanted to make that sort of a positive thing, and so I have a line in the book towards the end where it says, "At the end of every day, we flap our wings and fly away." Illustration of the kids or of adults in this case, flapping their arms, because I want to embrace that aspect of it.
Particularly because I think a lot of these kind of things are not things that they're not going to go away.
Right.
I mean, that was something that we really had that I think we realized early on with Morgan, and for me. I think for both of us, writing about our child, there was that question initially of, well, in terms of privacy, should we be writing about our family and about our son's disability?
Right.
But it wasn't that hard of a question because he is so clearly different when you meet him that, within a matter of seconds, people pretty much know that something is up. They may not know what exactly. And that he'll probably always be like that to at least some degree. And so, given that that's just so much a part of who he is and who other autistic children are, it really made sense to embrace it.
It's sort of a guilty little secret among families with autistic children. When we read the headlines about rates of autism going up, that we sort of see another side of it. There's the silver lining for us that the more autistic kids there are, the better the understanding, the more services that we can expect. And that, I took that thought to its logical conclusion with this book. That was sort of the inspiration for this book about, what if everybody was autistic? Everybody understood what was going on with Morgan and the world were constructed that way.
Mm-hmm.
And, we might be moving that way, so.
Well, how is he noticeably different? And is it very different at 8.5 than it was at 2.5?
Well, it's different at 8.5 to me in that he is pretty definitely autistic now. You know, at 2.5, they called it autism spectrum disorder, and we didn't really know where he would be by now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's clear to us now that Morgan is an autistic person, and that's just what, you know, he's going to be autistic, and I don't know what the future holds for him, but there's sort of a surety now that we're not trying to move him away from being autistic.
Okay.
I mean, we certainly want him to adapt, you know, as well as possible to the outside world, and you want to try to head off behaviors that, you know, are particularly destructive or inappropriate in dealing with other people. But yeah, I mean, there was that sort of vagueness to the diagnosis initially, and a lot of caution on the parts of educators and doctors, where they'll say, well, it's early days. We don't know how things are going to progress. But, you know, at this point, we really don't know how he's going to continue to develop. But certainly in his interactions with people now, it's just so evident from the outset because, you know, even just basic things like if someone comes up and says hi to him, he's not, you know, no matter how much we drill him in how one is supposed to deal with that, he really has no interest in it. Mm-hmm. And so he won't return people's greeting a lot of the time, and he doesn't do small talk at all. He just really doesn't see the point. And so that, you know, in like playground interactions or, you know, relatives coming over and trying to talk with him, that kind of thing, it becomes obvious very quickly.
You know, would you talk about this idea of theory of mind? Is that right?
Yeah, that's that was a concept that was in part pioneered also by Simon Baron Cohen in his early work.
Mm-hmm.
That he came up with what's become kind of famous in autism studies as the Sally Ann test. And it's where you have you show two children, Sally and Ann, and they have a box with marbles in it. And one of them has taken one of them, while the other one isn't looking, takes the marbles out of the box and puts it, I don't know, hides it behind a planter or something like that in the room. And you then ask a child who's watching the scenario, okay, when Ann comes in, where is she going to look for the marbles? And you know, most children, virtually all children, will say she's going to look in the box because she doesn't know that Sally has moved the marbles.
Right.
An autistic child will say she'll look behind the planter because, and Baron Cohen's thesis for this was essentially that you need a theory of mind, the idea that someone else can perceive things differently from you. And that this other child coming into the scenario does not, in fact, know what you, the viewer, knows, and that this is one of the real characteristics of autism. That, and what makes communication so difficult, that I think a lot of the time an autistic child will simply be assuming that you already know what they want, and so they literally are not going to see the point of communication a lot of the time.
And is that, and does that help you understand Morgan better, that idea?
I think so. It certainly explains a lot of the frustrations he has, that when he wants something and we don't immediately understand what it is that he wants, it's...
he doesn't understand why you don't get it.
Right. He's not trying to be difficult. He's frustrated because he doesn't know why we don't immediately get it.
You know, I think it also leads a lot of autistic people to regard other people with sort of a detached, almost scientific, observational style. You know,
why is that?
Well, I don't. You may have heard Oliver Sacks wrote a book called An Anthropologist on Mars,
yes.
Referring to Temple Grandin, you know, the way she would observe other people's behaviors as if she was studying a foreign species.
Right.
You know, and you may have recognized Simon Baron Cohen's name because his cousin has become very famous, Sacha Baron Cohen.
Yes, right. I did. I read that in your book.
I'd love to be at that family dinner.
Yeah, really. But I actually see a connection. You know, I sort of wonder, we've often wondered if there may be a little bit of a streak. I don't even know if I should say this on the radio, but some sort of streak of autism running through that family, because in my first book, one of the people that I profiled was Andy Kaufman, to whom many people have compared Sacha Baron Cohen.
Yes.
And Andy Kaufman, that was what most of his humor was about, trying to get a reaction out of people and studying.
Oh.
And not everything that he did was funny.
A lot of it
was just very uncomfortable. And some people feel the same way about Sacha Baron Cohen's humor. But I think he's really, you know, that's what he's looking for, is some kind of reaction. And it's not always laughter.
Right.
But, you know.
The movie Borat is what he's just done. I should say that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Just observing sort of the human condition and human reactions that way is sort of an autistic trait.
There is, when you described Morgan, again, as a toddler, he also had this not uncommon, he had these abilities, right? He knew things. I remember this, there's a scene in the book where you had somebody testing him and he's running by saying, isosceles triangle, rhombus, and he's, right? He's going through a geometry phase or something, but you know, I wrote in my margins of the book when I read that, you know, where does this come from? And then you also ask the same question a few pages later, Paul, when you're talking about Simon Baron Cohen's work, and you say, you know, that Asperger watched, or no, you're talking about Asperger, that he watched some of his early cases become mathematicians and engineers and chemists and musicians, and you're talking here about comedians, you know, but you say, but if this cognitive underground existed quietly throughout society, where was it coming from? I mean, there's some real mystery in this, isn't it? I mean, across that spectrum, as you're talking about.
I think that one of the most curious things to watch, really, with Morgan has been, that as parents, we can create an environment for him where we try to encourage certain things or just try to provide a rich environment for him to learn in. But he's very self-motivated in terms of what he decides he wants to pay attention to,
mm-hmm.
and what he finds interesting. And if he finds something interesting, he just has this incredible focus upon it, and will develop so quickly. And I think that's very common in terms of autistic spectrum kind of behavior. That Asperger described, people who could do advanced mathematics among the children of his who were patients, but if you asked them what their name was, they couldn't tell you. They didn't even know how to respond. And I mean, it's sort of an extreme form of it in a way, but that really almost epitomizes that condition. That if there is something that captures their focus, it becomes an immensely powerful tool in many cases. If one's interested in the sciences or the arts or whatever. But one of the strange things about autism is that it's very difficult to harness that.
Right.
You know, you can try to put things in front of a child and in the hope that, well, maybe they'll be really interested in this and that'll be a constructive thing and, you know, perhaps it will be good for them in terms of learning a profession or having a hobby or whatever. But it's almost impossible to be able to guess what it will be that captures that focus, because they're really not interested in your judgment of what's important and what isn't.
But you know, the same thing is true of any child. You know, I mean, we don't...
Yeah.
None of us knows what is going to grab our children's attention or where their talents will be.
Morgan is passionate about musical instruments, but he's equally as passionate about YouTube videos. You know,
right.
There's something that seems very trivial to us and just as important as the symphony orchestra to Morgan.
I see.
Well, and specifically, he's become fascinated by the the bumpers or whatever, the
logos.
The logos, yes. That film production companies run right before a movie or a TV show starts, like the little Paramount Mountain logo and things
really?
Like that. Or the Universal opening that shows the revolving planet. And there's a whole community of people that are fascinated. The people who put...
there are hundreds of these posted on YouTube.
Yeah. people compile like histories of them into videos, and they're passionate
and
about
they
it.
They rework them. They make their own versions on their computers and parodies. And we had no idea. You know, it's funny. We don't usually think that Morgan has any social influences, but he actually picked this up from another boy at school who happened to be watching these YouTube videos one day.
And another autistic boy.
Another autistic child. Yeah.
I mean, you know, when we were talking a minute ago about these, the Peter the Wild Boy, and you know how he kind of somehow epitomized this question that was very pressing in that time. You know, what does it mean to be human? I mean, these kinds of traits of autistic people also really, you know, are in an extreme way make you ask questions like where does curiosity come from, and creativity, and even knowledge, because it seems like certain kinds of knowledge are already in young children that aren't there in other children, right?
I think for me, one of the most curious things to watch with Morgan has particularly been his interest in music, because there seem to be things with music that he just naturally seems to understand. I'm fairly sure he has perfect pitch.
And that's quite common, isn't it?
That turns up a lot with autistic children.
Right.
And he'll just pick out tunes by ear and play them on the piano and that kind of thing. And that's an ability that comes up a lot. And I don't know where that comes from exactly. We have lots of instruments around the house, but he's never taken a lesson. And has kind of no interest in taking lessons. He just really wants to deal with instruments on his own terms.
And can he play them? Does he just know how to play them somehow?
Yeah, he figures them out. And it's funny how innate that is. And I think particularly how a lot of these kinds of abilities come up over and over again in different autistic children.
Mm-hmm.
For example, there are a few things that are almost... as soon as you hear about it, you just go, "Oh, that again!"
Right.
And one of them is, a perfect pitch or the ability to pick out things on a piano like that. Another thing is a fascination, for example, with mass transit systems.
Hmm.
A lot of autistic kids are fascinated by bus schedules and bus numbers and railways.
And they memorize them, don't they?
Yeah, they memorize a lot of this stuff. There's actually a tremendous fascination with Thomas the Tank Engine among a lot of autistic kids. And I think it's because there's a whole little self-contained universe of this island and all these named engines. And the other thing is, too, this occurred to me recently, if you've ever seen Thomas the Tank Engine, the trains have faces on them, but they're not terribly expressive. There's only... You know, they don't have hundreds of facial muscles.
Right, right.
The way humans do. They only have a few expressions. And so for an autistic child, it's much easier to interpret the train than it is to interpret people.
I remember somebody commenting one time that there are a lot of autistic children who were big fans of Japanese animation or anime. And one of the reasons they thought was because in the animations, the expressions of emotion are so strong and clear-cut.
Stark,
you know, there's not a lot of nuance.
They have wild hair and outfits, but their mouths and their eyes are...
Yeah, yeah. If they're either furious or afraid or, you know, and it's there's not a lot of in-between. So the autistic kids can watch it fairly comfortably knowing what's going on. There's nothing subtle to pick up on.
Mm-hmm. I have also read somewhere that many autistic children are feel a kind of affinity with characters like Dr. Spock in Star Trek, or I wondered about Commander Data as one of my heroes in Star Trek, The Next Generation. And I mean, that actually, is that true of Morgan or other autistic children, you know?
He's a little young for science fiction.
He doesn't remember them either.
Absolutely. The fact that you say that you're a Data fan makes me think you might be one of us.
I know. I know. It made me wonder, too. Because there is in those characters, in Spock and Data, the brilliance and the kind of perplexity at how strange, how strange and complicated normal human beings are, right? With a range of emotions and interactions and and what a mess that is sometimes.
Particularly when you have a character like Spock, who's supposed to be sort of both worlds.
Yes.
You know, he has one foot in the human world, mm-hmm. And the other one isn't, and he's trying to figure it out and trying to somehow reconcile this. And I think that's one of the reasons that a lot of autistic people find him to be such a sort of a sympathetic character, because his situation kind of mirrors their own. They are very much part of our world and you know, draw from it and actually help make a lot of the things in our world as well. And yet it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to them. And particularly social interactions are just there's so much to social interactions that can't really be explained very logically. You just have to intuit them. And when you actually try to sit down and explain it to someone, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Well, you know, that's the thing. I mean, when I read you kind of, you know, getting to know Morgan, getting to know this, what autism is, what it means in him, that you step back from some of what we consider to be normal aspects of life and realize, in fact, how illogical they really are, that we take this for granted, this degree of chaos.
Yeah, and I, one of the difficult things too with, you know, with for an autistic child to learn how to deal with social interactions is that often they work best with learning things step by step.
Okay.
You know, that you can't necessarily just tell. And I mean, this comes up even with really basic things, like, for example, toilet training an autistic child is a very painstaking process, and you can't take any step of it for granted. So, you know, you can imagine dealing with full-blown social interactions with crowds of people, that you actually have to break it down into a real step-by-step process for them a lot of the time. And if they miss a step, they can suddenly become kind of disoriented.
Right.
This toilet training is sort of a famous example because a lot of autistic children, including Morgan, when they go to preschool, use a system of little picture cards. And when you go into the bathroom at an autism school, you'll see above the sink, it's not enough to just have a sign that says wash your hands. There's a little picture card for the water and then for the soap and then for the towel. Mm. And, you know, because they need to have it spelled out for them. It doesn't necessarily follow. They need a system.
I wonder... I'm just thinking. I got so many notes. I had so many. I was fascinated by so many things and had so many questions. I'm going to stop for a minute, actually, ask my producers behind the glass if they have questions they want me to ask you, and then we'll keep talking. You can take a break.
Okay.
Take a glass of water or something. I'm going to be quiet for a minute.
Actually, yes. I'm coughing.
Okay.
All of a sudden.
I think we can do that in script or even through a reading. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's kind of where I wanted to go next. Are you there?
Oh, yes.
Okay. All right. Another thing that really interested me and kind of surprised me to learn as I was getting into this is how for so long autism, what we now call autism, was grouped together with other quite diverse and often very different conditions like schizophrenia or Down syndrome. And that, in fact, it's fairly new that... That autism is even named and kind of is becoming understood. And yet I have the feeling that also just because of what science is able to do now with brain imaging and what we know about the brain and mapping DNA, that there is a whole new world of understanding. I'm just curious about if you're experiencing that and, you know, what can we know now that the parents with an autistic child can dream of you know, even maybe 40 years ago, 50 years ago, 10 years ago?
You know, I just want to jump in because mm-hmm. Paul has most of the scientific knowledge here, but 40 or 50 years ago, there were still a lot of Freudian thoughts about autism, including, you know, infamously Bruno Bettelheim.
Yes.
Who was looking for, well, not looking for, because I suppose you could say he was a charlatan, but was telling parents that they were, especially mothers, that they were to blame for the children's
right.
autism.
Right.
And we're luckily well free of those bad old days. But, you know, without knowing a cause, it can be very difficult for the parents to sort of accept what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll turn it over to Paul.
Well, let me, before you get to Paul, I just want to, following uh-huh. in that, I wonder if because of that legacy of, you know, Bettelheim and that stigma that did last, that somehow it was terrible mothers and childhood traumas that were to blame when children were like this, if that's one reason that maybe you don't hear people talking so openly about how autism or traits of autism run in families, that somehow maybe it's not some outside agent, but in fact something in us and in our families that it's connected to.
Yeah, and I can understand that because the family traits don't explain why there is a rising rate, an ever-increasing rate.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, one of the things that I have sort of posited is that now people like myself and Paul, it's possible that in a previous generation we would not have met and married. You know, we might, I won't say that we are necessarily oddballs, but yeah. that, you know, there we both have traits that might have taken us a different direction. So it's possible that may contribute to it in some cases. We definitely feel like there is a family connection, but, you know, how much it is, it's a mystery. And
yeah.
we can't say that this is what's going on.
I mean, but it comes through creativity and accomplishment, right? It's connected to those things.
Absolutely. It's, you know, yeah. You know, I'm the daughter of a math major and musician who, you know, is not a person, I don't know how to put this, actually. is you know, not a person whose focus in life is human behavior,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think none of us are you know, Krista, I'm gonna back off of this because I think I'm going the wrong direction here.
Okay, I got you.
So, right. But you know, I come from a family that have a lot of these traits, mm-hmm. and so it's easy to see.
Okay,
how
all
it
right.
comes down.
All right. You want to?
And I think, oh yeah, I think for a lot of parents, you know, particularly after the initial diagnosis of a child, that there's a really understandable desire to want to know how did this happen.
Yeah.
And being told that, well, there seems to be a set of genes that, and it may be up to 100 different genes, and we don't really know exactly what combination or what environmental influence there might be in triggering it, but there seems to be a genetic element as well, and perhaps a very strong one. It's not really like a satisfying answer for a lot of people. People want a direct cause. And so I think that's made it very difficult for a lot of people to deal with. And there's a certain element, I think, for a lot of people of guilt, you know, that if they see these traits within themselves or within their families and you sort of have this reaction of, have I somehow passed this on to my child? And I mean, the short answer, I guess, is yes, that in the way that you pass anything else on to your child.
Right.
And so it's sort of unavoidable in that sense that how can a child not, in part, be deeply influenced by who you are?
Mm-hmm.
And yet that's not it's not something that should cause guilt. But I think it does for a lot of people. And that makes it – that genetic element, I think, makes it – probably as with any genetic condition, a very difficult thing for a lot of parents to contend with.
Mm-hmm. It just struck me. Was it Asperger who said, who one of his definitions was that autistic people are not, don't experience themselves to be part of an organism, kind of a world unto themselves. It's kind of what we were talking about a minute ago.
Yeah.
But what this DNA, you know, talking about it genetically this way does in fact suggest that they are very much a part of the organism in elemental ways, physical ways.
And one of the curious things in recent years, I mean, there's, I think in terms of the rise in the autism rate, one thing is one element of it has certainly been that there's just much better diagnosis.
Yes. Some people say that accounts for the whole rise. Don't
right.
They?
And you know, autism wasn't even really conceptualized or named until the early 1940s. And initially, actually, because Asperger's paper was not translated into English, for a long time in the English-speaking world, at least, the concept of autism was pretty much limited to the more sort of obvious or profound forms of autism.
Mm-hmm.
And now that there's a whole concept of an entire spectrum, it means you have far more diagnoses. So that's part of it. And in fact, there was, to me, a really fascinating study done in the 1970s when a lot of mental institutions were being shut down. And they did exit exams on a number of patients. And they were finding a lot of these people had come into these institutions before the notion of autism even existed, and
right.
Had been given this, you know, tremendously wide and often very vague variety of diagnoses. And coming out, they found that the majority of the patients in these places were autistic.
Hmm.
So they've always been part of society, but I think for a long time they weren't being diagnosed, and they were actually being hidden away, so to
right.
speak. They were being institutionalized, so they just weren't a visible presence for a lot of people.
Hmm.
You know, you may be aware that the author Nick Hornby has an autistic child as well.
No.
And at one point, Paul was in contact with him, and about Morgan, and he wrote back that he didn't realize that Paul was in the club. And ever since then, when we've come to think, when we see somebody who we think might be autistic or on the spectrum, we'll say, you know, I wonder if he's in the club.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that occurs to us, you know, when we're watching, for instance, the spelling bee or something like that.
Right.
That comes up a lot.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I have to say, I've been thinking about that differently just since I was reading your work and also just looking into this. And anyway, Stephen Jay Gould, Paul, you quote from his chapter
right.
on his son, and I got that, and it's just beautiful. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, for me, talking with some of the other parents of autistic children, I think that initially we didn't have a whole lot of contact. And it was sort of difficult. I suspect a lot of parents run into this, that because of privacy laws in schools and in medical institutions, you can't simply ask someone, oh, is that child over there autistic?
Right.
They won't tell you. Even if your child is in an autism classroom, if you ask the teacher, oh, are these other kids also autistic, you won't really get a straight answer. So over time, you finally meet other parents that you finally find out, yes, their kids are autistic too. And but initially, we didn't really have that. And so, yeah, but, you know, there are certain authors that have been very public about talking about their autistic children. And so for me as a writer, that was actually a really nice thing to be able to do was Nick Hornby and I have some mutual friends. And so to just approach him and say, I'm in this situation too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting too, because his response to me at the time was... He said, try not to think too far ahead because it won't do you any good. And I think my initial reaction to that was that I thought, wow, that's sort of a despairing thing to say.
he is British.
Yeah.
Yeah. He has a stiff upper lip.
Very doer sort of reaction. But the funny thing is, as I've gone along, I've really come to see the wisdom of that comment, just in the sense of, you know, obviously we're always thinking about Morgan's future, and it's impossible not to think, you know, what's going to happen 10, 20 years, from now, or, you know, what's going to happen when we're not around?
Right, and any parent wonders that as well.
Yeah, every parent mm-hmm. has these worries, and they're just all the more heightened when you mm-hmm. have a child with a disability. And so that's always in the back of my mind. But his basic point that, you know, for one thing, you just simply have to deal with you have to prioritize. You have to deal right. with the day-to-day things. And also, particularly with an autistic child, it's so hard to know exactly how they're going to develop and, mm-hmm. and what they'll take an interest in and where that will take them, that it's almost not that constructive to really obsess over the distant future too much, because it's just so hard to tell, and you need that energy for other things.
Mm-hmm.
This also came into play when we were, you know, thinking about having another child, because on the one hand, you know, we thought it would be really great for Morgan to have a sibling. And on the other hand, we didn't want to sort of, you know, have a child born with an obligation to Morgan's future,
mm-hmm.
you know. And that's something you think about when you have a child with a disability.
Now, this was the kind of cliffhanger ending of Paul's book 3 years
right.
ago. So did you have another child?
Oh, yes.
We did. We have a 3-year-old.
You do.
And as far as we can tell, he is not autistic.
Mm-hmm.
It's really like a different thing. We're parenting for the first time in this new, you know, this new mm-hmm. way, this typical way that the rest of the world parents. So, so it's very different. Yeah. And, you know, when the pediatrician, Morgan's pediatrician, found out that we were going to have a baby, she was very excited. She said, oh, he'll be in Morgan's face all the time. Any boy is
yes.
he ever. He loves Morgan. He just thinks Morgan's the greatest. And Morgan likes him.
Uh-huh.
Morgan likes Bramwell, but he likes him in smaller doses.
Like any older brother.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask you this. You know, I've had several, you know, conversations over the years about children as little philosophers and little theologians. You know, that in childhood we start asking these great existential questions. Where did we come from? Is there a God? If there's a God, who made God? You know, and also ethical questions like why do people hurt each other? And I wondered, do you experience that kind of those kinds of questions, that kind of side to Morgan?
I'm not sure how abstractly he thinks about these things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my feeling, and I won't speak for Paul since we have different feelings on this, but mm-hmm. I feel that that we all come into this world with a sort of immediate natural relationship with God. And so that for Morgan, he has that, you know, that's just the way it's always been for him. He has that relationship, and it's unaffected by whatever society has to say about it. But I don't think I think that we have to introduce ideas of ethics to him, because this sort of thing just simply doesn't occur to him. He's certainly not cruel,
right?
But he doesn't have getting back to the theory of mind, he just doesn't spend a lot of time thinking about what other people are experiencing.
Right. So I suppose if he's not. He can't really. He's perplexed by other people's reactions. Then I suppose part of being kind or compassionate would be such a complicated interaction, kind of beyond the way he
absolutely.
The way his mind works.
I don't think it's impossible for him. Mm-hmm. I just think that it needs to be taught, because it doesn't come to him immediately the way it might come to us.
One thing we've actually had to teach Morgan with his little brother is how to comfort his little brother. And, and I mean, we're still at the stage where we have to remind him that, you know, if something happens and Bramwell gets upset, or if, you know, he falls down and skins his knee or that kind of thing, that the appropriate thing to do is to ask if he's okay, or to, you know, to give him a hug or something like that. And otherwise, it doesn't really occur to him. And not out of any sort of cruel
right.
or callous sense of it, but just that I think it really doesn't occur to him. And that issue of empathy is a very difficult one, I think, for a lot of autistic people. Because I think for those particularly not familiar with them, it may seem kind of pointedly callous, when in fact it's... I think just it kind of comes down to a lack of understanding of the situation a lot of the time, and they don't see the point in it.
So, I mean, Jennifer, when you say that you believe that he has a, you know, that we all come into the world with a relationship with God, but with Morgan, is that just more something that you intuit, I suppose, because he doesn't communicate in the way that he doesn't talk about things the way non-autistic people talk about things. Is that what you're saying? It's just something you believe.
Absolutely. That's right. And, you know, he doesn't speak very abstractly about anything. Mm-hmm. And the sort of window into his soul that we have is usually through a sort of a code that's based on the books and videos that he consumes. So he often somehow puts together phrases and characters from books to express something. And of course, nothing's coming to mind right now as I say that. But you know, he will express something by way of mentioning, you know, the Cat in the Hat feels sad. Or that sort of thing.
Okay.
That's how he lets us know that he's thinking about somebody being sad. So we just have to, we understand that when he's putting together these to other people meaningless expressions, that they are his way of interpreting the world, which he does primarily through literature, because he doesn't really pick up on scenes in person. You know, he picks up through scenes in books and videos what human interactions are about.
I think that human interactions are much too fleeting for him to have a chance to interpret them, whereas he'll read a book over and over again or watch a scene in a video over and over again and can really try to figure it out or at least kind of memorize it as almost a kind of a script for dealing with the world in a way that, the in-person interactions, they're not repeatable in a consistent manner for him, so it's very difficult for him to figure them out.
Kind of makes you think that the 21st century is not a bad time to be born as an autistic person with all this rich world of media that we have, the way you're
Absolutely.
Talking about.
Absolutely. I have no idea what autistic people, how they spent their time before the computer. Absolutely.
Well, we needed them to invent the computer, too. Isn't that right?
Yes.
Isn't the inventor of the computer one of the people in your book, Jennifer,
yes,
Autistic
absolutely.
Heroes, Alan Turing?
Yeah, Alan Turing. And it took a lot of people to invent the computer, but he's one of the sort of the father of modern computing. And, you know, I think a lot of people look at him as somebody who really had a lot of difficulty in the world because the world that he needed to exist in really hadn't been invented and didn't come along until several years after he was no longer with us. So I think he's a great example of somebody who would really enjoy living in our time.
And, you know, you did, Jennifer, your book, you also have this book, is it My Autism Heroes. Is that the title? Sorry, I didn't write that.
Different Like Me. My Book of Autism Heroes.
Different Like Me, My Book of Autism Heroes. And it includes, you know, people like Albert Einstein and Alan Turing and female mathematicians I've never heard of. And the first, what was it, the first African-American scientist.
I had never heard of most of these people.
Yeah. I mean, some of them, Temple Grandin is in there, right? But, and there are those amazing stories and this category of savants, which is associated with autism. And that is so fascinating. And then, you know, but then what I also know is that all autistic children are not gifted, and there's some new research about girls in particular, autistic girls, that they have higher rates of depression and suicide, and not necessarily these skill sets that that autistic boys often have.
Right. And that is something that, you know, Paul and I have sort of spoken of this openly, and Paul wrote about it, but Morgan does take antidepressants. And we feel like when he was first diagnosed, we resisted medicating him. And many of the other children that we knew, autistic children, were medicated. But there came a point for him after we made a move across country where he just became very distressed and couldn't function. And it's not so much that we wanted to change who he was. We sort of wanted him to be able to be who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, the depression was interfering with that. And Paul, actually, I'm going to turn to you because I like what you said about it, him emerging.
Well, I think that he, the move, and it had actually been kind of building up for a while as he got older, that he became more and more sensitive to things that frustrated him in the outside world, and more and more overstimulated by them, and really didn't know how to handle them, and would get very upset about it. And the move really brought that to a head. And so at that point, it actually wasn't a difficult decision, because we also had a small child, and you know, he would and Morgan would be thrashing around, and so there was a real physical danger at that point. So it was actually a very easy decision in that sense. It was just necessary, and he kind of became his old self, and it was sort of a remarkable thing to see. And his old self, not in the sense that suddenly he was no longer autistic. He's, you know, very much so. But,
right.
But he could be sort of happy in the self that he already had been. And so that's also another thing about the era that we live in that makes me feel extraordinarily fortunate.
Yeah.
Because there's just no, for me, there's no question that in a past era, even just 20, 30 years ago probably, for one thing, he might have been institutionalized from the outset, but certainly once he became difficult to manage physically, and getting really frustrated and that kind of thing, he probably would have been institutionalized at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And as it is, that's still a situation that a lot of parents find themselves brought to, where they have an autistic child. You were sort of bringing this up earlier that not all autistic children are going to be these wonderful prodigies and sort of miracle stories.
Composing music and solving complex mathematical equations.
Right. And there's a real temptation for a writer to want to focus on those stories.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly that's a comparatively small number of people. And you can see those kinds of abilities in lots of other autistic children. But they're going to also have all kinds of challenges and actual retardation in some cases, and also physical problems. Like there's a lot of epilepsy, for example, among autistic children. And these can present huge challenges. And in some cases, for the some families, really for the good of the household, either wind up having to heavily medicate their children or to institutionalize them. And it's it's one of those things that I think, from our experience, it's a difficult situation for a parent to be in when it comes to that. And yet you have to watch out for your family and for your child's well-being. And I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, when Different Like Me first came out, I actually did receive some criticism from people who said that, this book just talks about how great these autistic people are and doesn't focus on the challenges. Way too optimistic. And I used to joke to Paul that I'm going to call my second book The Sad Lonely Bedroom.
Right.
It'd be the flip side.
Would you still, when you talked about Morgan, and again, I keep checking myself because I think a lot of the generalizations you can make about Morgan or autistic children, you can also make them. As a toddler, you call them. He was really happy and playful, right? He may not have been communicative in the way some children his age were, but would you still describe him as happy and playful at 8 and a half?
Yeah, I think he's generally a happy child. He's quieter now,
And I think. Yeah, but that's what I mean
older.
Is true of between any 2.5-year-old and any 8.5-year-old. That's where I keep catching myself. Yeah.
Yeah, he internalizes much more, mm-hmm. I think. You know, he spends a lot of time thinking about, and of course, you know, to some extent it's our influence because Morgan is a climber. That's just what he does. You know, he'll find the highest point in any environment that he
really?
Can get to. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we've had to get him down off the piano and off the kitchen counter, and you know, and so I think to some extent that has sunk in a little that he has to tone it down. But still, when we get to the playground, although his quietness actually aids his stealth, that if we have our back turned, we'll turn around and he's the highest point in the landscape.
So. Yeah, that comes up with a lot of autistic children where they love climbing on things like that. And yeah.
How do you understand that? Is there something you know that explains
that? Seems
to
be.
I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's some great metaphor here about how, you know, they're rising above the,
right.
you know, the rabble of society
yeah.
to look over us. But yeah, he just always has loved that.
He's just always loved doing that. I mean, it's funny because in that sense, yeah, he's had to become a little less exuberant for his own safety.
Yeah.
But generally he's a really happy kid. And usually when frustrations come about, it's just dealing with the outside world. When he's doing his own thing, he's actually quite happy.
Hmm.
And I that's one of those things. I think that's true for a lot of autistic kids. But by the same token, it's not true for some. There are some that deal with that are just in a lot of distress much of the time and have to deal a lot with issues of depression and things like that.
Right.
And that is one thing I'm very hopeful about, that, you know, autism being a condition with a very strong genetic element and one that clearly shapes your sort of neurological development from the get-go, I don't know that science is necessarily going to come along with something that will somehow reverse all of that. It seems mm-hmm. unlikely in yeah. that sense. But I do think that we live in an age where there's much more hope that some of the more challenging or really difficult aspects of it can at least be mitigated a great deal. And yeah, that makes me feel very fortunate. I mean, that's already the case to some extent. It makes me feel very fortunate to live in this time.
Yeah,
that we're able to say, you know, we have a happy, healthy, autistic child, which I think is something that previous generations were not encouraged
to
think
of it that way. Put all those words in a sentence together.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I was really struck by this, these lines, Paul, in your book, because you were, I think, along the lines we've been speaking. So Isaac Newton was another person in Jennifer's book, completely single-minded person who happened to be focusing, as you say, on something other people found important.
Right.
And you said there are Newtons of refrigerator parts and Newtons of painted light bulbs and Newtons of train schedules. And Isaac Newton happened to be the Newton of Newtonian physics. And you cannot have him without having the others, too.
Yeah. And I think that's I mean, there's two things that brings to mind, actually. I was in Italy not too long ago. For some reason, the book's actually been really popular over there.
Hmm.
A journalist there asked me, well, what if we were able to do genetic screening for autism?
Yeah.
And I said, well, that's actually a really difficult question because what are you prepared to lose?
Yeah.
I don't know if anyone would argue necessarily against addressing issues of really profound autism and of some of the very real and profound difficulties that autistic people face. But those sorts of abilities and the traits that show up in the families around them, yeah, I don't know if you want to lose those. But the funny thing about that, too, is that it's very hard to control where that focus is going to go.
Yes.
And I think it's funny, too, because in a way, some of the situations that we find ourselves in are not really that different than what other parents find themselves in. It's just heightened a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think all parents have to deal with at some point in their lives the realization that their child, that you can influence your child's development and you can try to provide the best environment possible around them, but you can't actually actively mold who they are. It, to some extent, it's up to them and to the choices and to the inclinations that they have, and what they choose out of that environment that you've provided for them is kind of be out of your hands, and that at some point you just have to accept who they are.
Yes.
And I think typically that's an issue that comes up in adolescence or, you know, in young adulthood. And it's just that with an autistic child, that issue comes up a lot earlier.
Yeah.
You know, and that you realize that...
And I think the possibilities, again, the spectrum of possibilities, there are things to be scared of that you know about, maybe that other parents can't imagine or...
Right.
Yeah, I mean, well, we certainly worry about how he's going to make his way in the world.
Mm-hmm.
By the same token, I think it's, you know, that idea of there being Newtons of different abilities or of different subjects. It's so hard to know what a child is going to put their focus on. Really any child, but particularly so with an autistic child. And it's important to them. And if, you know, in some very fortunate circumstances, it may turn out to be something that's incredibly important to lots of other people. But I think in a way, often it doesn't matter to them. It's the interest is inherent within the subject. And if it happens to interest you too, that's fine. But they're not out to impress you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that we tend, our public discussions about autism tend to focus on children. And, you know, as you're saying, as parents, you're looking ahead into the futures. And we don't hear very much, the general public, you don't hear a lot about autistic adults. There's a really interesting book that was published by Kamran Nazir. Have you seen that book? Send in the Idiots. And he is a policy advisor in the British government who, as a child, was put into a home for autistic children and then went back and sought a few of them out to see what had happened to them. I guess the subtitle is The Other Side of Autism. And, I mean, here's something he wrote, and I'd like to read this to you, and I'd like to know how you react to it. This is piecing together some things from near the end of his book. He said, it's unusual for autistic individuals to become top-ranked speechwriters or computer scientists like Craig and Andre, two friends of his, but progress is legion. However, what is significant isn't simply that we're less idiotic than before. It's also the means that we became this way through exposure to the world that lay beyond the horizon of our own selves. Our autism eased in each case because of other people, our parents, friends, and our teachers, of course. This realization sometimes expands inside me until I feel as if my organs are going to bruise one another. I was interested in what he says as that last sentence about how it makes him feel.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. He actually contacted me as he was working on the book, and when he did a reading in Iowa, we were at the reading together, and I introduced him. And I think the project that Kamran undertook, it was such an extraordinary thing, and the fact that he was coming from an autism classroom himself,
yes,
and undergoing or undertaking this extraordinarily social project,
yes,
of tracking down his old classmates and interviewing them, which is like mountain climbing.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what
climbing metaphor is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That you know, for someone who is autistic himself to be undertaking something like that indicates such a as you put it, a widening of horizons,
mm-hmm.
and such a tremendous effort. It's really almost a, you know, I think could be called a heroic book.
But he did find that the other people, I mean, I guess one of his classmates who he sought out had committed suicide, a girl.
Yeah.
But they did have lives. They had relationships. They had jobs.
Yeah.
And I think what's in, we talked early on about the definition of living in your own world, but what he does suggest is that through the care of parents and friends and teachers, autistic individuals are able as adults to move beyond that enclosed self.
Very much so. It depends though,
yeah.
because there's such a wide spectrum of autism that, you know, there are some people that are always liable to need an aid, basically,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and to not really be able to deal with the outside world on their own. And then that kind of goes all the way to the other end, to the other end of the spectrum. One of the more interesting phenomena of recent years with autism has been that because Asperger's syndrome was not really understood and the paper on it hadn't even been translated until about 20 years ago,
yeah.
All these people who are adults are now kind of retroactively getting diagnosed with Asperger's
right,
syndrome
right.
And discovering that they'd been living their whole lives this way. And suddenly it all makes sense to them. The common reaction in a lot of those cases is, I wish I'd known this when I was younger, because
mm-hmm, yeah.
it would have explained a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So these are people who have lived out, lives and gotten jobs and gotten married, but, had this, unusual set of characteristics or abilities or way of framing the world, and they had no way of understanding why it was like this.
Yeah. I think we've followed this Michael Apted film series that I think now the last one was 49 Up for several years.
Yeah.
Have you seen these? Where they
mm-hmm.
started with a group of children.
I haven't seen them.
Then,
I've heard about them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They've filmed them every 7 years. These are British children. And I think they're now at 49. And one of them that we watched with interest, Paul and I felt, was probably on the spectrum. And he had a very difficult life because he suffered from depression and he was sort of a loner and ended up for a while living on his own out in a trailer out in the Scottish Highlands. And then he reconnected with one of the other members of one of the other children who were now as they were adults and returned to society. And that seemed to really make a difference for him, and I think that society is very important. It's difficult for people who maybe, parents who may be on the autism spectrum to themselves
mm-hmm.
to embrace society because, we mm-hmm. want to stay home and do our, do our thing. But for him, it really made a difference. And I sort of have been focusing on that a little bit recently, that we try to take Morgan out into the neighborhood and people know him at the shops and so forth. We have him pay for his ice cream cone when we're out, and mm-hmm. I really want him to sort of start connecting. And even if he doesn't know the people that are our neighbors, they know him, and that I feel like is going to be very important as we move forward. That people know Morgan,
mm-hmm.
and
for him and for them, I suppose.
Yes. Well, yes. Especially important for him, though, because, mm-hmm. We moved away from the city where we live for a couple of years. And when we came back and went to some of Morgan's old haunts, people still know him. And that amazed me because, the sort of minimal social skills that he has, people remember Morgan. And I'm hoping that bodes well for his future.
That's one thing, too, that makes me very hopeful as well, that I think we now live in a time when, because autism is getting so much more attention, that over time people are likely to be much more aware of when they see these sorts of behaviors in someone else, to not simply avoid contact with that person or to think that the person's being contrary for no reason or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're living in a time that's likely to be much more accepting and understanding and patient with people who may be dealing with the world in a different way. And I think that's one of the interesting things about Cameron's book is that he found actually quite a range in a way of, I mean, going from one of his classmates committing suicide to all the way up to one who was very high functioning and very successful, and also various sorts of situations in between where people, some of them were having quite a few difficulties even
yes.
now.
Yes.
And I think that in a way that was it's a very honest way for him to put it, that, it's hard to know how it's going to go for your child in adulthood. It's hard for any parent to know, but there is that whole range of possibilities. There are things to worry about in profound ways
mm-hmm.
for parents of autistic children, but at the same time, a lot of them do manage to make their way in the world in a very, you know, constructive and happy way.
I guess, you know, we've taken a lot of time. I feel like I could talk to you much longer, but I think we should wind down. But I do want to ask that, you know, come back to this large question behind all this. You know, even as you're talking, Paul, I'm thinking, again, it's a spectrum that's parallel to the spectrum of what we call normalcy, right? Because if I went back and visited 5 college friends also, I would find someone who had committed suicide, and I would find a range of healthy relationships and unhealthy relationships, and not those particular
right.
challenges, but illnesses, right? Or disabilities, or I don't know. How does living with Morgan and the way you've had to think about autism, how does that change the way you think about some of these great existential questions, or, you know, what it means to be human? How does it change the way you live, think about yourself?
I think, you know, it's probably really had 2 big influences on me in a way. One is that I think I've become, I would hope at least, much more patient and empathetic with other people when they're acting in ways that I don't understand. I think that in the past, when someone seemed to be acting oddly or seemed to be sort of very socially awkward or just doing things that seemed kind of unnerving or didn't make sense to me, I would just think, well, what's that guy's problem, and you know, maybe avoid them, and that's a natural reaction for anyone to have.
Yes,
but at the same time, when I see that now, I actually find myself asking that as a genuine question. Well, what is that person contending with, you know, or what is it like for that person? So I think that's part of it. And I think that another big influence that it's had on me is that it's helped me understand myself and my family in a different way. You know, in seeing these traits showing up in other families and seeing them showing up in my own family, it's made me realize that some of the problems that I have, you know, for example, in having a difficult time hearing people sometimes, or focusing too much, are also some of the things that just make me who I am. And without those qualities, I don't know that I would be the same person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably true of many people for many behaviors, that you want to mitigate them to the extent that they're destructive, perhaps, but that at the same time, a lot of these kind of things shape who you are and actually shape your abilities and how you interact with the world. Mm-hmm. And Morgan is just a more sort of heightened example, maybe, of that.
Yeah, I wanted to say that one thing that has come up with us is Morgan really loves the goodwill, which is not a place that I gave much thought.
The goodwill, the store, the...
Yes.
Uh-huh.
I have to say that Portland, Oregon has some of the finest Goodwills I have ever experienced in my life.
Okay.
And Morgan will ask for the Goodwill, and we love to take him there because I never would have thought of this before, Morgan, but it's a place that's very friendly to people with disabilities. And when I'm there, I often see other people with developmental disabilities and people who I might not have noticed before. And now I do. Now I think about, you know, how to make their world as comfortable as possible. And that's just a place where they can be. That's you know, that's comfortable and accepting. And you really do, when you're there, you feel like you're part of a community, even if you've never seen, you know, if it's a store full of strangers to you, it gives me another perspective on interacting with people who might be invisible otherwise.
Do you think of Morgan's autism, do you think of it as a word, as a disability? Does that word work?
Yes. I might not use it in some context, but I think that it's important to acknowledge that Morgan has challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And to look away from them, I don't think would serve us at all. You know, and I am the most positive, gung-ho autism mom you can imagine.
Right, and I mean, you're the one who wrote the book about autism heroes and the geniuses.
Right.
So I think this is, it's really important that that's the context in which you make that remark.
But there are two things. You know, one is that I don't want to imagine that he doesn't, you know, that he isn't facing any challenges at all. The other thing, of course, is that Morgan needs services. And mm-hmm. as an advocate for him, I don't want to whitewash any difficulties he's having, because when it's time to be the squeaky wheel as parents, we've got to step up and say, Morgan needs these things. You know, okay. Morgan needs help. And so I don't think... I know disability is a word that bothers some people, but for us, it's a word that has meaning, okay. which is, you know, Morgan has needs, just as anybody does, and we need to acknowledge them in order to fill them, okay. to meet them.
Anything else, anything either of you wanted to say?
Oh, no.
I think this is wonderful. I've so enjoyed it.
Great conversation.
I hope you have.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I'm just looking behind the glass. I think we're producing this next month. We've got some vacations coming up, but I wanted to get the interview in. So we will let you know exactly what's happening and dates and all of that. But probably it'll be after Labor Day. Anyway, more people are listening to the radio after Labor Day.
Oh, great.
People will be back. Oh, well, thank you so, so much for making the time and for talking to me. And I really loved spending this time with you.
Thank you. It's been great for us, too.
Yeah,
thank
it was really nice.
All right. Okay, so somebody will probably be sending you emails. We may have some follow-up questions, and that'll be in a couple weeks. Thanks a lot.
Great.
Okay. Thank you. It was nice to meet
you.
You too.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.